to the L. Barrio, you know we got flow. East Harlem, home of the Bogner Show. Listen, podcast dishing, easy going. On the show where the hot air's always blowing. Downloading, never miss an episode. Keep it real, always serve it Alamo. New York, New York, if you can make it here, you know the rest, you can make it anywhere.
This is episode 95 of the Brad Bogner Show. Our guest today is Jack Weatherford, author of Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. Now, actually, before we get started, according to the book, the name is actually pronounced Genghis, not as commonly referred to in Western culture as Genghis Khan, if I'm not mistaken.
It's better if people can say Genghis, but I think it's understood in other pronunciations as well.
Yeah, because and then it ended up being that the spelling, it was something about it tied into Persian, and then their pronunciation just ended up being the Genghis, which we always know so well.
Exactly, because most of the Western accounts were based on Persian accounts, and just because of the way their language was, they had written it with a G sound, which then became Genghis, often in English, but Chinggis is Mongolian, Chinggis.
I thought that was what was so fascinating, not just all this stuff on Genghis Khan and all the conquering and pursuits that he led, but just the development of this book. You're actually one of the few people that's ever been given access to this part of Mongolia that was kind of blocked off for this 800-year period that was kind of his birthplace and burial grounds, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yes, I don't know if given access is the right... I just happened to arrive at the right moment in history. I was just very, very lucky, you know. Mongolia had opened up quite unexpectedly with the collapse of communism around the world, the fall of the Iron Curtain. It had been, for 70 years, a hidden country there between China and the Soviet Union. But all of a sudden, it was possible to go there, and I arrived there in the 90s at that time. And I was very fortunate then that I had a lot of freedom because the Mongolians at that time were enjoying tremendous freedom to go almost anywhere.
And one of the kind of works that you also draw heavily on in the compilation of this book is The Secret History of the Mongols, which is kind of something that's also existed almost since the time of Genghis Khan, but had never really been released to the public. And that actually contained a lot of, you know, useful information, I guess, to kind of get the whole history behind the man.
Yes, that's the other fortuitous event, that the secret history was available at this time. You know, it was a document that was written very soon after Genghis Khan died, but it was kept, as the title implies, secret by the family. They didn't want it to contain many personal things about him that they didn't want to release. It wasn't just a public relations biography. It was a very personal biography. And so what happened, though, was that it was so secret that it was almost lost. Then during the Ming Dynasty, the Ming decided to start using it as a translating device for teaching translators. And so they printed up some copies. Then those were, again, neglected as no one needed to speak Mongolian anymore. And they weren't found until the middle of the 1800s. And it's a long story, but it really isn't until World War II that people started seriously working on the translation of the book, because the Russians were very afraid that it contained a secret about how to conquer Russia. The Germans were hoping it contained a secret about how to conquer Russia. Turned out it had no secrets about Russia at all. But nevertheless, work was begun again on translating it. So it was not until the 1980s that the book was published in English for the first time. And it wasn't until after World War II that it was even available in Mongolia, in the Mongolian language. So it became available late in the 20th century. Then 1990s, a country opened up. For me, it was just, let's say, a fortuitous circumstance. I was very fortunate.
And I guess speaking of, you know, fortuitous circumstances, that might be the best place to start. Because when you think of these great conquerors in, you know, human history, like, I always think of Alexander the Great, and that's a guy who comes from a strong pedigree of royal family, tutored by Aristotle. And then you take Genghis Khan, for example, and I mean, this is a guy whose mom was kidnapped while she was pregnant with him, gives birth. He's kind of an outcast almost, and not really destined for any greatness. It's not like he had the, advancement already in place for him.
You're absolutely right. The steppe of Mongolia itself was a fairly remote area and a reasonably poor area, even at that time. But his own clan was even more remote, living in a kind of semi-forested area close to the mountains. They were very remote. And then at age 8 or 9, his father was killed, and then his mother and his siblings were all put out basically to die. They were just left out on the steppe. The clan felt that they could not feed all those people. Genghis Khan's father left behind 2 wives, and he left 6 children by the 2 wives. And then there were a couple other people in the family who were there, an old grandmother, and the tribe simply put them out, assuming that they would die. Part of the miracle of it all was that Genghis Khan's mother, as you say, she had been kidnapped herself. She'd been through a lot in her young life already. But in the words of Mongol secret history, she pulled her hat down on her head. She tied her skirt up in a knot. She took a black stick and she ran up and down the banks of the river by night and by day, digging out roots to feed the gullet of her brood. And she helped every one of those children to survive. It was a harsh life.
And you kind of mentioned that too. Genghis Khan just never wanted to give in. Always had a strong desire to succeed. And you mentioned early on that he's got that strong duality, sort of. He's able to be very friendly, very loyal to his friends, but at the same time, he can also express that same friendship as enmity. You know, he had a strong rivalry with his half-brother. He had, you know, those problems with his blood brother, Jamukha. It's a guy who definitely, you know, didn't like to play second fiddle. He kind of always wanted to be the main person in charge.
Well, I think you hit on exactly some of the themes why the secret history was kept secret, because of these issues, such as he had an older brother who I think was just slightly older than him, and not more than 1 year at the most. But anyway, his older half-brother, who tried to dominate over him, and he absolutely just would not take it. And so he killed his older brother. And that, of course, no society is that looked upon with much favor, and consequently was kept secret. It wasn't even known until the secret history was rediscovered. However, it certainly fit with a lot of other things. As you say, he also had a blood brother to whom he had sworn great loyalty. The two of them parted ways, and then Genghis Khan ended up executing him. There are several episodes such as that in his life. But also, I think it's important to note that people betrayed him a lot, too. Not only had his tribe kicked him out, but time after time, people in his own family, his own relatives, uncles, and other relatives betrayed him in various ways. Even when they swore loyalty to do this or that, they betrayed him. So he was a man who faced a tremendous amount of difficulty. Yet those people, and they were always non-relatives, I must say, those people who stood by him and never, ever wavered in that, he never wavered in his support of them. He never wavered. And the men who rose up to great power with him were some of the poorest from the steppe, but they stayed with him, and then their descendants, enjoyed wonderful life for many generations to come because of that loyalty.
And what you just said was very interesting, too, in terms of what had been done in the past, whereas most leaders, you know, they appoint family members in high positions of prominence. That wasn't really the case with Genghis Khan. He really did want the most loyal people around him. And like you said, if you scratch his back, he kind of scratched your back. And that was also part of his immense success.
Yes, he had a certain charisma. He attracted other young men his age who started fighting with him. And they became very loyal to him from the beginning. And then they rose with him. And as he went up step by step, they went with him. He never turned away from them. And as I say, he also rewarded them more than his own relatives, because his relatives sometimes were not faithful. But even at one point, Genghis Khan's own mother was complaining. Why did they get all of the loot or the booty from the different campaigns compared to what she was getting? She was even irritated at that, but he was quite serious about rewarding those people who helped him, whereas he himself didn't really care very much about the rewards, which is sort of odd compared to most conquerors, as you say, such as Alexander the Great and others in history.
The facts are quite impressive. You know, in 25 years, the Mongol army subjugates more lands and people than the Romans had conquered. In 400 years, Genghis Khan conquered more than twice as much as any other man in history. What was really crazy about that is that Mongolia was only about 1 million people in this time period you mentioned, and the army was only roughly 100,000 people, which they would go into these battles 3-1, 4-1, clearly outnumbered, and still come out victorious oftentimes.
You're absolutely right. At the most, he had about 1 million people in his nation once he united it in Mongolia. If you think about today, McDonald's Corporation has about 1 million employees in the United States alone, not counting the rest of the world. Walmart, as I think I read, about 1.6 million or more employees around the world. I mean, his nation was small. And this army of 100,000, that was compared to, say, overall in China, there were about 1 million armed men at that time, of whom about 100,000 were armed cavalry, and the other 900,000 were infantry. So he came up against tremendous odds. And what you bring up here about that point, it's important not just militarily that he was a great strategist, but a man like that who can come up and then conquer hundreds of millions of people, he is doing it not just through the military, not just through the bow and the arrow and the horse and the discipline of the troops. He is also attracting large segments of the population where he is fighting.
And yeah, like it was also mentioned that he was kind of able to think on the fly and always improvise and always improve. He never fought the same war twice. He was always able to learn something new in battle and apply that in future battles.
Yeah, so in part of that, a little bit of that is a Mongolian tradition. And the Mongolians, if they go by one route, they believe you should never return by that route. You always seek a new route out just to learn something, try something new. But in his case, being kicked out of the tribe, they were always fleeing from people who were coming by, raiders. And he always had these episodes in life where he really had to improvise because he was totally alone and had no one to depend upon at all. So he grew up that way. And then as soon as he left Mongolia, I guess this is a man already around 50 years old or so before he ever left Mongolia on a campaign. And he gets out there and hears a world. This is a man who, to my knowledge, had never seen a building. I knew of no building that he could have ever seen in his lifetime. There were some ruins of buildings in Mongolia, but no standing building. So here's a person with very little experience, and he got to the cities. You can imagine what that's like. You've grown up in this very isolated area, very few people around you. And yet he came up very quickly with a simple idea. Okay, those buildings are, they have mud walls, was the first city he came to. It had mud walls around it, but a very big, formidable barrier. And he just diverted the river. He knew that water could dissolve mud. The first time he did it, he flooded his own camp. However, they perfected that. Eventually, by the time the Mongols reached Baghdad in 1258, they took the city by flooding it, by diverting the rivers. So it became a way of improvising and learning from the mistake, not to dwell on the mistake, not to repeat the mistake, learn from the mistake, and go forward. There were times when he even took his sons out and other generals to a battle that he felt something had gone improperly or been done wrongly, even if they had won it. And they went over it step by step. He was very methodical, very thorough.
What was interesting, too, was that the Mongols were masterful at propaganda. They loved to inflate the numbers of people murdered on these conquests. They liked to strike fear at the heart of the opponent. Because oftentimes it was common, at least when Mongolia was fighting the steppes amongst each other, they'd try and avoid battle at all costs. It was just kind of a matter of, who's the scaredest, I guess. And that kind of applied to his other conquests as well.
Yes, he really had one goal in mind when he went to battle. That was victory. If he wasn't going to win, he wasn't going to fight. He wanted to preserve the lives of his soldiers. With so few coming up against so many enemy soldiers, he had to preserve every life. So they would do whatever it took. They would flee. They would use trickery. They would pretend to be defeated. Then they would rise up again. They would do all that, but it's in the area of propaganda, really, of public relations, that he was quite different. If you look at someone, whether it's Napoleon, Alexander, or Caesar, their public relations always consist of one thing, being the greatest person there is, having beautiful sculptures made, putting your name on cities and on things, or building churches or monuments or temples to you and to God together, all this kind of stuff. That's how conquerors traditionally promoted themselves and used public relations. Genghis Khan, first of all, allowed none of that. He didn't allow his image to be painted, to be reproduced. He didn't allow anything like that. Instead, what he did was every time he conquered a city, defeated an army, he took a certain number of those people and released them in order to flee in the direction that he was moving, in order to spread the terror of the Mongols coming. And, of course, it was very effective. And it worked, and because it inflated the numbers tremendously, and people always want to make the suffering worse than it was. I mean, make the story more exciting, or in order to inspire other people to work harder to defeat the Mongols, or for whatever reason. And so the stories grew and grew and grew, but he was a master at controlling that flow of information.
Well, we're on the topic of, you know, what previous conquerors had done, and that was what was interesting as well, is that traditional armies typically would have taken over a place, they would have raided it, looted it, murdered, raped, pillaged the entire community. And Genghis Khan didn't really do that at all. He kind of took out the royal family leaders, let the peasants do whatever they wanted for the most part, as long as they were loyal, and then kind of used the people to his own needs. So, you know, if he wasn't good at mining, he'd find all the miners, and everybody basically served a purpose towards the Mongol Empire instead of just having the country kind of for the sake of having the country.
Yes, you're absolutely right. He was quite methodical in his approach. First of all, when he approached a place, he did it in the same way every time. That is, he gave them a very clear mandate. We are coming. We are going to conquer you unless you surrender. If you surrender, you will be protected in your goods, in your lives, in everything. And if you don't, then the phrase that they always used was, only heaven knows what will happen to you, or only the sky knows in the Mongolian. And so he gave them the choice. And if they surrendered, he was very good on his word. He stuck to that methodically and consistently. And there's one case, for example, the area of what is now Turkmenistan in Iran, where they were conquering his own son-in-law, looted a town that had surrendered to Genghis Khan. And Genghis Khan took him, stripped him of his rank, which was more or less a general in our terms, stripped him of his rank, made him the lowest ranking soldier in his unit, and made him go first into the next battle, where, of course, he was killed. He was very strict about this rule. However, if the people then violated that, and they often did at first, if they violated it, he was merciless in their punishment. Because he didn't have enough soldiers to leave behind a detachment. If he conquered one city, he only had a whole 100,000, and they're all divided up and scattered all around Eurasia, basically. He can't leave behind a delegation. They've got to agree to pay their taxes, to send them in, and be ruled by their own people. And very often, the conquered cities would see, oh, okay, we will just agree, we will agree, we'll agree, we will feed them, we will host them, we'll have a party for them, we'll do everything, and then when they're gone, we're going to ignore them. And that's what they did. And when they did, Genghis Khan sent the army back, and then there was no mercy. And as you say, he first killed all the rulers, all their families, everybody in a power position. He felt they would never have any influence for him, they would never have any use for him. But he did separate out every person who had a useful trade, whether it's the people who knew how to weave or work metal or write or doctors, all of these people. And certain ones even were granted tax exemptions forever, medical people, teachers, all kinds of religious people, didn't matter what the religion, they were always given a tax exemption. So he was thorough, he was methodical, he was very kind towards people who were loyal to him and to their word. He was merciless to those who were not.
And you just touched on the tax exemption for religions, and that's kind of what made Genghis Khan stand out as well, is that he had complete and total religious freedom for anybody in his reign. His inner circle consisted of Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and that wasn't really something that was common at that point. It was sort of my religion or the highway.
Yes, and this was a way in which he was able to get the loyalty of many minority people in the areas that he was conquering. So he would go in, and people recognized that he would grant them religious freedom. And by freedom, it did not mean just the freedom to worship as they please. Of course, they had that. But also, it meant tax freedom. The normal people would be taxed at the same rate no matter what religion, because at that time many countries had different tax rates for different religions. And then the people in authority over the religion, the people who were in the monasteries or operating the temple or the mosque, all of those people would be tax-free forever. They would never be taxed on their lives or on their property. And so it was quite a fair system. So when, by the time the Mongols, this is after Genghis Khan's life, but after they got to Baghdad, for example, it was very much the Christians who sided with him, the Jews who sided with him, and many of the minority sects of Islam sided with the Mongols at that time. So he was very effective in using religion, but he was also quite serious about giving total religious freedom. He felt that he couldn't say which God was exactly right. As his son explained to a visiting envoy from Europe, a Christian envoy who came there from the King of France, he explained the religions of mankind are like the fingers of God. Which finger can you remove? Everyone had its own place, every religion and every idea. And Genghis Khan only asked that they pray for him and his family. That was his only request.
So as Genghis Khan's nearing his end and trying to pick a successor amongst one of his sons, it was an interesting process in that he had spent so much time conquering all these other places, and he had generally been so mistrustful of different relatives in his group, he hadn't really groomed a successor. And it ultimately ended up, you know, being a negative impact on the Mongol Empire, as his children that all ultimately took on after him kind of, you know, sort of just didn't have a lot of success, and they did everything he would have probably been opposed to.
Yes, this is the sadness of the tragedy of his life. And that is, like many of us, we have some virtue or some good part that we believe in, some ideal that we hold, and often we can't stick to it ourselves. And he had this ideal of always of rewarding people based upon their achievement and their accomplishments and not upon birth. But late in life, he favored his sons, and he wanted them to have his property. He just somehow, he loved them too much, even though he recognized their lack of training. And he didn't realize till late in life that he had not really trained them effectively. And this is when he instituted more of this going out to the battlefield with them, trying to find scholars and sages from all over the empire he brought in to try to instruct his sons. But they're middle-aged men. A middle-aged man is untrainable. There's not much you can do with them after a certain point. And unfortunately, they did not live up to his standards. But towards the end of life, he called a meeting of the family, and he discussed what would happen when he is gone. As he said, even the tallest tree falls. And so they had to discuss what they should do, because the Mongols have no simple succession. It's not as though, well, the eldest always takes it or the youngest always takes it. They had different systems that they used, that the youngest had certain powers, the eldest certain, and so on. But he called a meeting, and then, as usual, he would call on his eldest son to speak first, because the eldest could always speak first. He called on the eldest, and as soon as he did, the second son jumped up, because the eldest had been born soon after Genghis Khan's wife had been kidnapped and brought back from captivity. And the second son jumped up and said, "How can you let this Merkit bastard speak?" Because the Merkit was the tribe that had taken him. "He is not your son." And Genghis Khan said, "If I say he is my son, who are you to say he is not? You were not there. You don't know what your mother went through. You don't know who your mother loved and who your mother didn't love. I say he is my son." It was a horrible moment in the family, and brought together all the tensions of the past within the family. And in the end, they chose the third son as the one who would follow Genghis Khan. And they chose him not because he was the most capable, but basically because he was the best liked, and he was the best liked because he drank the most. That was not an auspicious beginning to the next phase of the empire of the Mongols.
And despite some of those rocky successors, I mean, it was still pretty remarkable that for nearly 700 years, you know, till his death, until Stalin, you know, went in there and took them all out, basically, that one of his descendants ruled over that country. It's one of the longest family dynasties in human history.
Well, his descendants have ruled in many places throughout Central Asia. It wasn't in the case of Central Asia until the 1920s that the last descendants were removed. But of course, even the Mughal emperors of India were descended through the female line, at least, if not through the male, from Genghis Khan, and they were very proud of that. And there could be his descendants still in some places in the world today. The fourth Dalai Lama was a descendant of Genghis Khan. The Mongols were very, very successful in a short period of time, but then they continued to have a greater influence on the world for centuries to come.
And that's where, I mean, because most people, I imagine, that are listening to this or don't have a lot of experience, you think of the Mongols as a completely bloodthirsty, ravaging, terrible people. And in actuality, that was something that had kind of come over from sort of a European and Central Asian sentiment, a negative attitude towards the Mongols that has existed to this time almost. And I guess since they've just had such a stranglehold on controlling that history, you know, we think of somebody as a mongoloid, almost like Down syndrome, or just a bloodthirsty pirate. And I thought it was so interesting that that's the case when it doesn't really match with reality.
Yes, but you know, when people lose to foreigners, they usually were going to portray them in a very negative way. And of course, you had people losing all the way from China to Hungary against the Mongols, and then they always portrayed them as you said, exactly, bloodthirsty. And they were efficient in battle, there's no question. I mean, the Mongols fought hard. They killed a lot of people in battle. But so did every conqueror in the history of the world. That part is yet not unique to the Mongols. What was unique was their success. But unfortunately, it wasn't recognized by most of the world. People tended to minimize it. And especially during the era of the conquest of Asia and Africa as a part of imperialism from the West, it was very hard to look upon those people as having one time ruled a great part of the world. But it's very interesting that it wasn't until, in some ways, in the Enlightenment, that some people began once again to re-examine this person in history. And the greatest historian in British history, I would say, is Edward Gibbon. And Edward Gibbon was one of the first to bring up in the 1700s the fact that Genghis Khan had total religious freedom and that the Europeans had never been able to achieve it. And he attributed it, the whole idea in the West even of religious freedom, to the Mongols. And a lot of people were very interested in that. George Washington, throughout his life, had a book on Genghis Khan in his library. Thomas Jefferson had a different book, but a biography of Genghis Khan. Benjamin Franklin, in his bookstore at the post office, sold copies of the biography of Genghis Khan. They had a different view. And now I think it's time for all of us to really re-examine history. It's a good time, anytime's a good time to re-examine history, but especially with people such as the Mongols, people we've tended to demonize in the past.
Did you by chance, I think like 5 years ago, the movie Mongol came out that sort of focused on his earlier life and then ends kind of with that rivalry with Jarmukha. Did you by chance see that movie?
You know, it's very interesting, Brad. I did not see it, and I chose not to see it because, you know, if I see a movie or something like that, it gets so real in my head, it's hard to shake it off. And I was a little bit afraid of being overly influenced. One day I'm going to see it. But I talked to a lot of Mongolians about it, and while they loved the scenery and they loved the view, everybody said it was beautiful. There were things in there that I knew offended the Mongol sensibility. And that was another reason I did not want to see it, because it had scenes in there about Genghis Khan's wife and so on that were very unpleasant to the Mongols. And she's the mother of their country. There are just certain things you don't say and do. I mean, it goes back even to the way Genghis Khan spoke to his sons about her. You know, she was his wife, and he loved her very much. And if he said she was the mother, I mean, if he said he was the father of her child, then who were they to say that he is not?
Right, he actually risked, you know, a lot to go and capture her when she had been kidnapped, so I'm sure he did not appreciate that sentiment from his children.
Right. He loved her very much, and this is an aspect of his life that was very much missing from history. he decided at this young age of, he was probably 17, perhaps only 16, but when she was kidnapped, that he would rather die than to lose her. He had found happiness in, after all the terrible things in life, of being enslaved, captured by other tribes, cast out by his own tribe, having gone through hunger and imprisonment, all these things that he'd gone through. And then he found this girl that he truly loved. And you can imagine at age 16, the intensity of the feeling. And then to have her kidnapped from him, no, he would give up anything. He decided to have her back. And he sacrificed a lot, but he got her back.
I believe the book was released around 2005. Have there been any new developments since the release of that book? Because I know, you know, even like you said, in the 90s, a lot of information was coming to light. So,
well, you know, there's more interest and there's more research going on, in part because in Mongolia, having not been able to research him in the 20th century for the most part, scholars are looking back at new things. Archaeologists are moving around. There's a genetic the studies being done. So I think there's a lot going on. I tend to wait a very long time after something is announced in order to sort of digest it and think about it before I have a strong opinion about it. But I'm very excited that just so much is going on. And I think that the world really can learn a great deal from Genghis Khan, especially today when, you know, our ambassadors and our foreign service personnel are killed in countries around the world. Genghis Khan had a law totally forbidding the killing of any envoy from any country for any reason, even if you were at war with them. And he punished very severely people who did that. Even today, we don't have that kind of diplomatic protection for people around the world. He had total religious freedom, total. It just didn't matter what you believed. We still don't have that in the world. I think there's a lot we could learn from him.
Absolutely, and the book is Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. Jack, thanks a lot for being on the show today. I really enjoyed talking with you, and best of luck to you going forward.
Thanks, Brad. I appreciate it, and the very best of luck to you and to all your listeners.
Great, thank you, and have a great day.
Thanks. Bye now.
Bye.